of the Bolivarian process as he wraps up his North American tour in Portland. An evening with Charles Hardy, writer of Cowboy in Caracas, May 20th, 7 p.m., Liberty Hall at 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. Sponsored by your handcrafted community radio station, KBOO.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and I'm Michelle Schroeder Fletcher. Today we have with us in studio, as part of the Illihi Lecture Series, Money Talks, David Sirota. Most of you know him from his important contribution to Air America and his many media articles. He's created the Center for American Progress, the Progress Report, and MoveOn.org's Misleader. Many of you probably remember his very timely and enlightening book that he had in 2006, Hostile Takeover, which examines how the political corruption has resulted in public policies that squeeze the American middle class. Good morning, David. Thanks for being with us at KBOO.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being in Portland. And before we talk further, I want to ask you a question. I hear your book is coming out in paperback.
That's right.
And that will be out available.
I think the official date is May 22nd.
Well, we're big fans at KBOO, and we, you know, during our pledge drives have really gotten great response and review. And second, before we talk further about your appearance tonight, I want to remind our listeners that you'll be speaking at 7:30 tonight at the First Congregational Church, which is 1126 Southwest Park. And for further information, they can always go to www.illahee.org or phone 503-222-2719. David, those of us who are familiar with your articles realize that you write on such a disparate and varied issues, the media, politics, war reporting, and try and turn that into how they actually affect the middle class and everyday Americans. Since we here at KBOO talk a great deal about the media use and words and how they really matter, I was reading one of your, recently, you were talking about the PBS Bill Moyers special on the war, and what you said was so insightful. Quoting you, what's really disturbing, however, is not even what this documentary says about the past, but what it says about the state of journalism today.
Absolutely. This documentary went through, what happened in the lead up to war, how the media was complicit in cheering on the war, as opposed to playing its historic role of questioning the facts, questioning, for instance, suspect premises for this war. And it speaks volumes not just about an anomaly. You know, what happened in the lead up to war was not an anomaly, but has become the what I would say is the norm. Is that worshiping power, bowing down to power, enabling power has now become the media's MO. And that is a real threat, I think, to democracy. You know, the way democracy works is we need to have a meritocracy of ideas. The best ideas are supposed to percolate up, withstand public scrutiny. The First Amendment is supposed to allow that scrutiny. Well, if the institutions charged with administering scrutiny to ideas, the media is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If those institutions are not playing a role of a scrutinizer and are instead playing a role of a propagandizer, we have a problem where our entire meritocracy is under threat. We have a problem where there's more likely that bad ideas, dangerous things, horrible, destructive policies will percolate to the top. There's no check on power. I mean, that's why they usually people have called the media the fourth branch of government. You know, the branches of government are set up to create checks and balances. The media, though not a branch of government, is always supposed to played a role as a check on unbridled government power. And as we've seen, it's now playing a role as an enabler. And whether it's playing a role of an enabler of policies that, let's say, progressive support or conservative support, that's not really the issue. Whether you're a progressive or a conservative, you should want a media
accurate.
To be accurate and to apply real scrutiny, almost to be what I would call skeptical, not necessarily cynical, but we want a skeptical media that feels the requirement to ask every question, for assertions to be not deemed innocent immediately or innocent or worthy, that there should be a guilty, I would say, you have to, the burden of proof on a proposal from the government, the burden of proof should be on the government. It should not be assumed to be what it is said to be. And I don't think that's a negative way of looking at things. That's what the media exists for.
We've been conditioned to believe that it's a negative way for those of us involved in the media, it's always interesting because we can disclaim Fox and, you know, some obvious and overt pandering. But it's really interesting and complex when you talk about the New York Times and how their whole lead up to war and the Judith Miller and everything else. And then the mea culpa done, you know, I mean, we are in the middle of the, you know, of the effects of not speaking truth to power, of not asking those difficult questions. I mean, that's one of the things that Moyers did that was so important was say, this is the consequence of that. And there's a lot of people that still just don't have any accountability.
And we're seeing it on many different issues. This week we're seeing it, or the last couple of weeks we've seen it on this secret trade deal being pushed by a handful of Democrats and the Bush administration. This is a deal that was announced late Thursday afternoon to allow a series of these quote-unquote free trade pacts to move through Congress. The deal was negotiated in secret. The legislative language of the deal has not been released either to the public, to the media, or even to rank and file Democratic members of Congress. And yet it is being trumpeted by the media as theoretically guaranteeing supposedly new labor and environmental standards, which would be good if it was true, and is being trumpeted by pundits and editorial boards, even though, again, the specific legislative details haven't been released. And the issue is, sure, we would like labor and environmental standards, but as we learned in NAFTA, that the rubber hits the road on the details. You can't make conclusions about whether those labor and environmental standards are enforceable unless you see the text of the agreement. And yet the media is out cheering on this deal.
Actually, out front.
Out front cheering on this deal and making assertions that this deal will definitely mean enforceable labor and environmental standards, again, when we don't know that's the case. And what's very interesting about this is sad, is that reporters have not learned or don't care about the lessons that we as a country have learned from NAFTA. NAFTA, as I did on my website, I went through old articles.
And give that out right now.
Yeah, my website is www.workingassetsblog.com. I'm at the Working Assets syndicates my blog. That's where you can find it. And what I did was I looked at editorials and news articles from 1993 when the media was making assertions about what NAFTA would do. There's a big New York Times, speaking of the New York Times, mm-hmm. editorial that said NAFTA would mean, had provisions in it to make sure that that Mexico's environmental standards would be better, would increase under NAFTA.
Rather than allowing
corporations to create
exploit
a race to the environmental
mm-hmm.
bottom.
Mm-hmm.
We know what happened. We know that what the New York Times and the media asserted at the time about NAFTA's environmental standards was not the case, did not happen, was never supposed to happen because the text of the agreement wasn't written in a way that it was enforceable. And yet now we are here 14 years later, and we are hearing about another trade deal negotiated in secret. And we are being told by the same media institutions that this deal includes the very same things that they told us NAFTA would include. So this relates, of course, to the issue that Moyers brought up, is that the media has now become an enabler of power rather than a questioner of it, not just on the war, but on every issue. And the question for us is, how do we get to the truth? How do we make sure that this scrutiny happens? Because if it doesn't happen, we are under an assault on our democracy that goes even farther than any of the election reform issues. If we don't have a media asking basic questions about the issues, then we're not having even a discussion about the challenges our country faces.
Yeah. And these, I'm speaking with David Sirota, who's in town and going to be speaking at the Illahis lecture series tonight. And it's appropriate that you would talk about NAFTA and some of this, because your real focus is the broad brush of policy and politics and how it affects. Well, first of all, quickly, give for those of the listeners who don't know you, which are very few, I'm sure, but some interesting background, Montana and your involvement in, you know, I mean, how did you come from there to here?
In 1999, I was working for then Congressman Bernie Sanders, now Senator.
Now a hero.
Now always
yeah.
a hero.
Always a hero, yeah.
He ran the first bus trips to Canada with seniors to highlight the absurd situation whereby Americans are now prohibited from buying FDA-approved lower-priced medicines from Canada. Remember, we're supposed to live in a free trade country, but under NAFTA,
Speaking of NAFTA,
a free trade deal, specific provisions were inserted in NAFTA, protectionist provisions to protect pharmaceutical industry's corporate profits and bar Americans from buying lower-priced drugs from Canada. In working for Bernie, I met a guy named Brian Schweitzer, who was a farmer who was running for a very, very long shot bid for the Senate in Montana. And he was making the bus trips to Canada, because obviously Montana's got a big Canadian border. He was making those bus trips a big part of his campaign. And over the course of that year, I got closer to Brian. I went out for his Senate race. Remember, he's a farmer running in a Republican state against a two-term Republican senator. And everyone thought we would lose widely, and he ended up losing by about 2 points, which was incredible. 4 years later, he ran for governor of Montana, and I went out again, and he became the first Democratic governor in 16 years in that state. And my wife and I decided to move out to Helena, where we now live.
Yeah. And although you live there and online, I'm telling you.
That's true.
You really do. And so speaking of that, one of the things that I read on your blog was a really wonderful, just small insight into how local politics plays over the broad brush of affecting people and how some of this works. Because I think a lot of our listeners understand the outcome, but they don't understand how the process works and what's kind of really going on. And because there's nobody reporting it, like you say, we don't get an insight into that. Can you give us that one little, you wrote on the blog about in Montana, how at the legislature, how some things occurred?
Right. What we've had happen in Montana is we've had an emergency special session of the legislature. The Republicans have they've made a lot of noise. The Republicans control the House. The Senate is controlled by Democrats. Each chamber is controlled by just one vote. And the House Republicans have dug in on the issue of taxes and in specific on tax collection and tax enforcement. The governor of Montana had come out with a proposal to use the state's $1 billion surplus, save about half of it, invest about another third of it into education, and use about 20% of it for property tax cuts, $400 a person, very progressive.
The reason I'm highlighting this is that we are having clearly in this state and in most states a similar discussion that tries to get off the ground.
Right, about taxes, and the issue is the Republicans want to cut tax rates, and when you cut tax rates, you give a bigger percentage of the tax cut to the wealthy. When you give an across-the-board tax rebate, the same amount for everybody, that is a very progressive way to cut taxes. So the millionaire landowner in Montana gets the same thing as the person who has a house in Billings. You know, and obviously for the $400, it was $400 a person. $400 for a person living in Billings
really makes a huge difference.
Right.
Difference, yeah.
The Republicans dig in on this, wanting across the board property tax cut rates. I'm sorry, property tax rate cuts. That apply to corporations in state and out of state. And perhaps worse, they opposed the governor's proposal to increase tax enforcement on out of state corporations. There was a study out 2 years ago that showed about roughly half of the Fortune 500 companies in Montana operating in Montana pay less than $500 a year in taxes,
yeah.
Which is an outrage. And what we saw here is the Republicans really dug in on basic tax enforcement, even though the revenue from the tax enforcement, about $30, $40 million, was going in the legislation, would be directed immediately into tax cuts, this progressive tax proposal. So in other words, increasing enforcement of making out-of-state companies pay the taxes that they owe, the revenue from that would go to give middle-income people in Montana a tax cut. And the Republicans opposed this vehemently because the lobbyists in the Capitol, this was the issue that they were unified around. And as I said, this is an issue, really, when you want to talk about class warfare. This is class warfare.
And some people don't.
Right.
The word is don't go there if you because it becomes apparent.
That's right. And this is class warfare. When legislators refuse to force out of state corporations to pay the taxes that they owe in order for those legislators to give their constituents a tax cut. That is class warfare. And so what I've said in my piece was that this is the kind of thing that's happening all over the country. This is the kind of thing that we need better reporting on, because once we get better reporting on it, I think more and more people will realize really what's going on. I think a lot of people do really realize what's going on. I think that has a lot to do with why, for instance, Montana, which has been a Republican state for a while now, is now trending back. It's why our governor, in pushing this proposal, is one of the most popular governors in the country. And the question is whether progressive office holders and the progressive movement has the courage not just to play defense, but as we saw in Montana, go on offense on an issue that the conservatives, in this case taxes, have owned for the last two decades.
And the reason I think that the reason I wanted to ask you about these particular issues is because, again, I want to say that David Sirota is speaking tonight at the Illahi Lecture Series, and the title of it is Money Talks, and that's been the theme throughout in terms of how it affects the environment, how it affects individuals, how it affects average middle class and average folks in the United States. And so it's been a really important topic, taxes obviously being the way that we collectively, you know, change behaviors and say what's important to us. On that note, also politics, you are in the Oregonian today, and it's in the Oregon's political process. The headline is New Ways of Thinking About Election Reform. So this is your other big theme, is politics and how we can affect those changes. So do you want to go on?
Sure. The article basically says that there are two ways right now that states can really fight back against the hostile takeover of our governments by big money interests. The first way is public financing of elections, which I know Portland has had an experience with. The Citizens Commission recently said it's been a very good experience. Obviously, there's always problems with certain aspects of things getting off the ground. This is the way of the future. And it's the way of the future because the main problem in politics, more specifically than just money in politics, it's not necessarily money in politics. It's money that comes with the expectation of specific legislative favors in politics. Candidates right now in non-public financing situations are forced to raise private money that is given to them with the expectation that those candidates, if elected to office, will do specific things. You know, think about the Halliburton contracts. Think about, you know, that's at sort of the national level. But it goes all the way down to every level. And so the way to deal with that is not to try to take money out of politics. Because I think, look, a democracy needs a well-funded democracy. We want our candidates to run campaigns, to communicate with voters. That is what democracy is about. And they need resources to do that. The issue is giving candidates resources that do not come with the expectation of legislative favors. And that's where public financing, I think, comes in. And that's why I think Arizona, Maine, now Connecticut, and some cities like Portland, New York City have done public financing. I think it's a worthwhile investment. I know the arguments are, you know, why are we giving money to politicians? But remember, that argument is absurd because the amount of money that's wasted when you don't have public financing. I mean, what was the last count? In the last Congress, there was $60 billion in earmarks. Earmarks are those special projects that lobbyists lobby for their, you know, specific, you know, contracts, the bridge to nowhere. $60 billion was wasted on earmarks thanks to a system
that rewards
financially, the candidates and politicians who push those things. So we're already wasting that money. The amount of money you could right now at the federal level spend about $1 billion to publicly finance all congressional campaigns. Seems to me that's a good investment in our democracy. And if it takes $1 billion of an investment to save, let's say, $60 billion in wasteful earmarks, that's not a bad investment. The second thing I said in the article was, as it applies to Oregon, is fusion voting. Fusion voting used to be legal in every state in the country. Fusion voting is basically where you walk into the ballot box and you see, well, here you vote.
Right.
You vote by mail. You look at the ballot, and on the left-hand side, you will see a list of parties, okay? On the top part of your ballot. So imagine a graph here. Left axis is the parties. On the top are the offices, okay? And in each box, a candidate is listed. And here's the key. A candidate for a given office can be listed on more than one party line. So when you look at your U.S. Senate line, okay, you would see perhaps the Democrat on the Democratic Party line, and on something like in New York, they have a Working Families Party line, which is about populist economic issues. So in New York, a lot of progressive Democrats, they run on the Democratic Party line and the Working Families Party line. Now, why is that important? Well, obviously, it's important because it gives, I think, multiple parties access to the ballot as opposed to what we have now, which is basically a duopoly. But here's the other thing. In fusion, if you vote for a candidate on, let's say you vote for, let's just say, Chuck Schumer in New York, the senator from New York. If you vote for him on the Working Families Party line, he gets your vote. They combined all the votes he gets no matter what line he's on. So you don't have to worry about spoiling or throwing your vote away. But here's the key part. You send a message to the person you're voting for, because what happens in fusion situations is that the smaller parties are based around core issues. So when you vote for Chuck Schumer on the Working Families Party line, you send Chuck Schumer a message saying, Chuck Schumer, I want you to focus your attention on issues like minimum wage, on issues like labor rights, on issues like healthcare, because that's what the Working Families Party has defined itself on. So when Chuck Schumer at the end of the day looks and sees that he got 5, 10, 15% of his vote
from that constituency,
from that line, from that constituency, he knows he has to be accountable to them, because in the next election, perhaps that line won't endorse him if he doesn't do the right thing. So it gives people a way to send a message to their legislators, their congresspeople, that says, that allows it to be a message based on issues. It's really an important piece of this, because right now we're sort of frozen out. We sort of have these two parties, and you know, an elected office holder, it's hard for them to discern what the electorate is what messages the electorate is sending
again,
to them.
Well, and again, we have the media that interprets the message of what.
Right.
I mean,
this way, there's no ambiguity. Right. If you know you got a certain amount of votes on a party's line, and that party is very clearly defined as having specific stands on very specific issues, there's no ambiguity. And the office holder knows that there's no ambiguity. And here's the other piece of this is that the party, the fusion party, now gives you, as let's say a healthcare voter, leverage to not just asking that lawmaker to focus on healthcare, but you now have leverage because there's the implied threat that if that legislator ignores that line,
then you'll take your vote somewhere.
Then you'll take that party will endorse somebody else, and that office holder will be at risk of not getting those votes. And I think this is a really critical piece. And as it plays in Oregon, and I'll be real quick here, this obviously would help create consensus. I mean, here's the thing. On the toughest issues of the day, the more votes you may get on an issue like contentious issue like healthcare, if legislators got a big amount of votes on a healthcare party's line, it would help them go to the legislature and say, we have a mandate for change.
Well, this is all very interesting. And speaking of mandate for change, we don't want to let you go before you make some kind of, I don't want to say prognosis, but we're interested in how you feel about the 08 elections and how that's going to play out, or any kind of speculation in that regard.
I guess I would say that I'm fairly concerned that about a Business Week article about 3 weeks ago saying that the two leading Democratic presidential candidates, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, are relying on their Wall Street donors to quote-unquote revise their campaign's official economic platforms. That makes me very worried. I think if the Democratic Party shies away from the kitchen table economic issues that clearly won it the election in 2006, I think we could have another Republican president. And I think that would be a real wasted opportunity. Because mainly not because it would be Republican, but because all the Republican candidates are just awful on the issues.
Yeah.
And so I hold out hope that either Clinton or Obama is going to realize that that's not the way to win the election, or that somebody like John Edwards, who is running on economic class issues, will move up in the polls and win. I actually have a feeling I guess I would say it's hard to speculate now, because I have a feeling something is going to be changing in the next few months.
Well, that's a very interesting. I want to remind our listeners again that we've been speaking with David Sirota, who is going to be speaking with the Illihi Lecture Series tonight at 7:30, and he'll be at the First Congregational Church at 1126. Southwest Park. And for further information, you can go to www.illihi.org. I also want our listeners to know that the next speaker in the Illihi Lecture Series will we will be broadcasting him next Tuesday at 10 o'clock, but he will be here May 23rd, and his name is Thomas Homer Dixon, and he's written The Upside of Down, and he will be with the Illihi Lecture Series, and we will have more information at the front desk should you need it. Thank you so much, David. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.